Learn more at skoll.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, the Trump administration is banning cruises to Cuba under new restrictions on U.S. travel to the Caribbean island imposed yesterday to pressure its government to reform and stop supporting Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The tightening of the decades-old U.S. embargo on Cuba will further damage Cuba's already crippled economy, as well as hurt U.S. travel companies that have built up Cuban business during the brief 2014-2016 détente. The State Department of the U.S. will no longer permit visits to Cuba via passenger and recreational vehicles, or vessels rather, including cruise ships and yachts, as well as private and corporate aircraft. The ban is effective beginning today. The U.S. will also no longer allow so-called people-to-people education travel to Cuba, one of the most widely used exemptions to the overall travel ban. Here to talk about the ban and the long and complicated relationship between the U.S. and Cuba is Patrick Mantega, editor and publisher of the weekly newspaper La Gaceta, which has been publishing for the last 97 years. La Gaceta is the nation's only trilingual newspaper, carrying news and opinion in English, Spanish, and Italian, and it's published right here in Tampa. And Patrick, nice to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So this ban, how significant is the announcement yesterday that this ban was going into effect?
It's probably been the biggest item in U.S.-Cuba relations in the last 25, 30 years. It's devastating to Cuba. It's devastating to the process that many of us wanted to normalize relationships. It's very disheartening.
So it mainly centers on cruise ships and yachts and boats going back and forth to Cuba.
No, it affects probably 90% of the travel of U.S. citizens who don't have relatives in Cuba. So it is going to affect airlines. While it doesn't ban them, it's going to take away their cash customers. And so currently out of Tampa, we've got 11 to 12 flights, most of them through Southwest. I think we've got 3 charter flights a week. And, to imagine that they're going to keep up that many flights when you're cutting their customer base so drastically is I just don't see it happening. So, we could lose all of our flights here.
So right now when people fly, they invoke this, I'm going on people-to-people travel? Is that how they usually...
Yeah, you have two main groups going down to Cuba. You have Cubans who have Cuban family down there, and then you have people-to-people travel. And under Obama, the people-to-people travel became so easy to do, and you just had to declare it, and you really weren't going to have OFAC come back and check your paperwork, to where it really became tourism. And so under tourism, most people are happy to go to Cuba. If you want people to go to Cuba to meet with the government, this strict routine of meeting with, this dissident and that government and over 4 days, who wants to spend their weekend that way? So under that, you had this tremendous group of this large influx of Americans going down there. And to meet that demand, there were a lot of private hotels being opened up by Cuban citizens because the government had allowed it and because there was a customer base for it. And then you had these private restaurants. When I first went to Cuba, 20 years ago, there were maybe 2 or 3 or 4 private restaurants. Now there's 500 in Havana. After this, you could look for half of those going out of business.
And those all accept American dollars? Or how do you pay?
It wasn't American dollars. I mean, it's whatever. Normally it's CUCs, Cuban convertible units. Mm-hmm. But Americans were the ones who were going to Havana, not Europeans. So while the European travel will still be there, a lot of the American tourism generated tips that Europeans didn't do. And so a lot of American tourist dollars went into the Cuban economy, went into people's pockets.
Mm-hmm. So up until today, if I booked a Southwest flight to Havana, did I have to file any papers with the U.S. government or the Cuban government, or could I just book the flight and go?
You generally were told at the airport what kind of travel you're choosing. You'd pick it on a chart. And that was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So all that ends beginning today.
Yes.
All right. So you mentioned OFAT. Is that the Treasury Department?
Office of Foreign Assets Control. It's under the Treasury.
Okay. And they would be looking to see if you are violating any sort of law. It's odd to me that Americans can travel to all sorts of countries, including Saudi Arabia, which has a terrible human rights record. We can travel to China, which has a terrible human rights record. We can certainly go to Russia, but we can't go to Cuba easily.
It's a bizarre U.S. policy. And what is even more strange today, if you take Donald Trump and John Bolton at face value, we're doing this because Cuba has too much influence in the Caribbean and South America. It has too much influence with Venezuela. Isn't it odd that the most powerful country in the world, the richest country in the world, says we can't play in the same field with Cuba in the game of influence? That the only way we can do better than Cuba is to stop Cuba from influencing its friends. America can't over-influence and can't beat Cuba in the game. We have money, we've got power, you know, and yet Venezuela wants to be closer to Cuba than it does to the U.S. Why? Obviously, we're not doing much of a job in trying to influence them.
We're going to take a few phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, and you can also contact us via email. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Patrick Mantega, editor and publisher of La Gazzetta newspaper, is here with us, and we're talking about the new restrictions on Americans traveling to Cuba imposed by the Trump administration beginning today. So what's happened to the people of Cuba since this detente has happened and was pretty big until President Trump came into office? The last few years of the Obama administration, relations were warming between the U.S. and Cuba. What happened to the people in Cuba? Were their lives getting better during that period of detente?
Like I said, you had a tremendous growth in private restaurants. You had a huge growth in taxis. You had a tremendous growth in the need for lodging and in tour guides. And so all of this was good paying jobs. This really helped build an emerging middle class for Cuba. And as this was happening, the Cuban government's biggest challenge was how to deal with all of this emerging small business and how to come up with a way of taxing them and how to come up with a way of making this work within their government. And it was a tremendous challenge to them, which is the way we could have affected Cuba was by just challenging them with prosperity. And instead, we've taken a different choice. And right now, the Cuban population is getting very desperate. People illegally trying to get to the U.S. has increased tremendously. There's despair. There's people who have a feeling of hopelessness. There's food shortages. It's gotten really bad very quickly.
Hmm. Do we still automatically let Cubans who come make it to the U.S. and make it to U.S. soil into the country?
There's no wet foot, dry foot policy. They certainly can claim asylum. And you know, that's going to depend on how the Trump government treats them on their asylum cases. But, you know, there has been a huge increase in this flow into Mexico and from Mexico into the U.S. Flights from Cuba to Nicaragua and have gone up like 900% of people going to Nicaragua. And then, of course, a lot of them are just walking up through the countries to get to the U.S. border.
So some of those people that we're seeing at the border these days in South Texas and New Mexico and Arizona and California, those are Cubans?
We are fueling the caravan.
We are. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. How many times have you been to Cuba?
I think it's about 13, 14.
Did you ever take a cruise ship?
No.
Yeah. Are there cruise ships that leave from Tampa to go to Cuba?
Yes, we have two of them.
And this ban impacts them right away.
They're gone. You know, this ban is an immediate effect to Tampa citizens. There are people who are working to help stock those cruise ships, to put food on them, that are going to lose their job, have their hours cut. If the airport cuts those flights, you're going to have Southwest Florida, Southwest Airline employees in Tampa lose their jobs or have their hours cut. Each one of these flights, each one of these ships is a pretty large amount of money that circulates through our economy. And so when you lose them, it's a big hurt. This is going to be a problem. Then you have all the business, the travel providers here. They're going to lose their business. They're going to lose their money. So there's a significant impact to our local economy.
So the argument that this is going to put pressure on Cuba to change and do more of what it is that President Trump wants.
Well, I guess what do we want? We want Cuba to stop influencing Venezuela? I mean, the biggest influence Cuba has on Venezuela is sending doctors there. So we would like them to stop sending doctors. They're not sending missiles. They're not sending ships. They're not sending jet fighters. They're not sending rifles and ammunition. They're sending doctors, and that's where we want them to stop. So I don't even know at the end of the game. I don't know what our game is here. What is a win?
Let's go to our first call. Well, the caller just dropped off. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And our email address, if you want to email in, you can email us here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. David writes this. He said, I'm very irritated with President Trump and his administration for denormalizing relations with Cuba. I think that we've made a lot of strides with Cuba via the travel policy under President Obama. I feel that Trump wants to undo all the great things that Obama did for the U.S. and because Trump is like a man-child, a jealous man-child. What is Marco Rubio's take on this new travel policy change, writes David?
Well, Marco Rubio is a cheerleader for this. They are employing the same kind of policy that was used in Cuba for the Bay of Pigs. You know, we're trying to get the population to rise up, to fight against the government. We're trying to strangle the Venezuelan government. And the problem is it's not working. You know, things are getting tougher for people in Venezuela. Things are getting tougher for the people of Cuba. But it's not working to create the change that we're trying to create. And part of this is because some of this change really is kind of counterproductive. I mean, you know, currently we want to be able to sue over getting property back, Cuban property back to Cubans who left there 50 years ago. So is the government going to say, well, we need to kick out our current residents out of their houses and give them back? I mean, who's going to do that? What Cuban leader is going to do that?
Well, and that's interesting because the Trump administration just said a few weeks ago that it will now allow lawsuits against companies that have taken over property of the families of people who are now living in the U.S. I hope I'm describing that correctly. But one of the targets, the cruise ships are using property that was confiscated way back in 1959, 1960 as a way to dock in the port of Havana.
So that person who now is living in the U.S. can then sue Carnival for docking and try to get money out of them for the use of confiscated property 50 years ago. And this is an unprecedented move. We've never done anything like this. I mean, you know, if this is the case, then let the Indians start suing all of us for where we're living, where we're doing business. Are we going to let the Vietnamese sue companies that are doing business in Vietnam who are on property that they used to own? This is a huge mess that if you start to do this with everybody, it becomes, you know, it's going to clog the U.S. courts. And it makes no sense. And so this is a provision of the Helms-Burton Act that every president has postponed allowing. Bill Clinton did this, probably the worst move Bill Clinton did as a president besides Monica Lewinsky. And he immediately realized his mistake and immediately said, well, okay, well, I'll postpone this for 6 months. And ever since then, somebody's done it. Every president's done it until Donald Trump. Because everybody knew this is really a political and legal disaster. This could clog our courts and take up valuable time that could be used for cases. You know, why should somebody who used to be a resident in a foreign country be able to use our court system to sue over a foreign matter? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, what jurisdiction does our court system have over property in Cuba?
Well, and that's why we have to now sue Carnival here, not the Cuban government. And so Carnival's now going to pay a price for something that happened 50 years ago where a person says their property was seized. Of course, I don't know what proof they have to the seizure versus abandonment. And so you just don't know, how's this supposed to work? It's bizarre.
We're talking about the Trump administration's crackdown on Cuba, and our guest is Patrick Mantega of the newspaper La Gazzetta. And let's go to David in Tampa with the first question. David, what's your question for Patrick?
Well, hi, Rob. I would just like to correct something that was said earlier regarding, sort of walking into Saudi Arabia or Russia. Those two countries, in addition to many countries in the Middle East and Africa, it's very difficult to get in. In the case of Russia, a few years ago, the visa charge alone was $350 or $400, plus you have to give them a lot of personal information that I would not feel comfortable giving them. In the case of Saudi Arabia, unless you're sponsored by business or you're there to do a big business, they just don't allow tourists to come in the country at all. And the list kind of goes on, and I just wanted to correct the statement that those countries were much easier to get into than Cuba is today.
Yeah, and
or
David,
was before opening up.
David, let me just make my point, though. I wasn't saying that those countries restricted us. I was saying that our government restricts us. So granted, to your point, Russia may have hurdles. But I'm just wondering, can you think of any other country that our government says you may not easily travel there?
Sure, North Korea. They're listed in your passport.
Yeah.
North Korea is there.
And yeah. But I mean, if you were to look at all the human rights violators around the world, and if you were to compare Cuba to China, for instance, where a million Uyghurs are being put in political re-education camps, some people call them concentration camps, would you say that Cuba's human rights record is worse than China's?
Rob, I frankly don't know.
David, you have a lot of answers. David, you had a lot of answers, so I figured I'd ask you the toughest question, and it appears that you can't answer that one. David, thanks a lot.
Talk to you again, Rob.
All right, thanks. The point is that, can you think of many governments that our country restricts us from traveling to? I think you can travel to North Korea.
You can, and I don't think you have this kind of bizarre set of rules about who can and who can't. I think North Korea, your biggest problem is trying to get North Korea to let you in.
Right.
Not trying to get the U.S. government to. But, frankly, there are some reasons why the U.S. government shouldn't let Americans go to North Korea. We've had to spend some serious dollars on trying to get people back out of North Korea. Nobody spent serious dollars trying to get back out of Cuba, except one guy who was working for the CIA throwing a few satellite phones around and got caught.
Yeah, in the Tampa Bay Times story today about the restrictions on travel to Cuba, the number of tourists flying from Tampa International Airport to Cuba is huge.
It is. Yeah. It is. No, this is big business, and we've ruined it. Now, there was a few things that are happening that I think will still be able to happen. People to people is the biggest area, but athletic competition still allowed. So I think a newspaper today mentioned that the regatta, the St. Pete Yacht Regatta to Havana, wouldn't be able to happen. But under the present situation, it could happen. Now, there might not be any U.S. spectators that are allowed to go down there, but as a competition, a race, that could still happen. If the Rays decided they wanted to go back and play somebody in Cuba, that probably could still happen. OFAC would have to approve it. You'd have to go through OFAC regulations. But those things are still not banned, and you or I could go as journalists.
Let's go to Juan, who's in Lutz. Juan, thank you for calling. What point would you like to make?
I'm sorry, I'm coming into the conversation a little late. Mr. Mantega, is it?
Yes.
Are you opposed to the restrictions that Trump is putting on Cuban travel?
I am absolutely opposed to those restrictions.
May I ask, were you born in Cuba, sir?
No. The last Mantega born in Cuba was my grandfather. He immigrated here in 1913.
Do you have any family in Cuba now?
Not that I know of, because of the policy that we've had. It's been very hard to keep in touch with family over 50 years. So, no, I probably do. I just don't know them because of the restrictions on trade and travel with Cuba. Going there and keeping in touch with obscure family just was not allowed.
And I'm sorry, do you benefit financially from travel to Cuba, the tourism industry?
I have a newspaper, and I can tell you the last thing in the world that's going to be sold in Cuba is La Gaceta newspaper. They don't support a free press, and so I have no way of making a dime from it.
Okay, well, I know several people who were born in Cuba, and I know they have family there right now,
mm-hmm.
and those people are starving.
Yes.
They can't get rice and eggs.
I agree with you.
But
they weren't starving a year and a half ago or well, 2 years ago, well, and that was the issue.
Juan, let me ask you a question. Do you think that the restrictions that the Trump administration has placed on Cuba makes the economy in Cuba better for those average people that are just existing on a few meager rations a day?
Well, the answer is that right now they're run by a military dictatorship. And the only people that are benefiting financially are those who are either military or tied to a military family. And you would not believe that the military dictatorship there has caused the entire culture to be dysfunctional, because turning family against family and friends against friends, because if anybody talks about freedom, then a family member is required to report it, or else they're jailed and they lose their job. So how are we going to change the government there, or help change the government there, if we do not boycott their tourism industry to overthrow that military dictatorship in a peaceful revolution of the people rising up and asking for their own freedom, or demanding their own freedom? And in that light, I will let you know that I began a petition on change.org called Free Cuba, Boycott Tourism, because, yes, the people will suffer in the short term, but it will be to the good. The people will find a way to resolve. They'll find a way to survive. But right now, the government is run by a military dictatorship. It is a brutal dictatorship where, if you try to speak up and say, we want our freedom of speech, we want our freedom of religion, we want freedom of the press, you lose your job and you go to jail.
We've tried it your way for 60 years. What do you think is going to happen now? We've done this. You know, I have seen change in Cuba by us opening up to them, allowing their economy to grow. You're not going to starve the Cubans into changing. You're not starving the Venezuelans into changing. Tell me who we've ever starved into changing, and why do you want to starve people into changing? What does it matter to you about this? Have you been to Cuba? I've been there. I haven't seen the things you're talking about. Now, sure, you know, is there going to be freedom of the press? No. But most people in America don't care about freedom of the press at the moment. They don't buy a newspaper. They don't do, they really don't support a free press. So the reality is that what you're saying, we have tried. There is nothing that you have in your playbook that we haven't been doing for 60 years. There's nothing new that Donald Trump's doing. We have tried to starve them in the 80s when the Soviet Union pulled out. We have tried to starve them in the 60s when we pulled out, and we're trying to starve them now. And every time they have stayed, you talk about a peaceful revolution, but you then say they're a brutal dictatorship. Well, how do you have a peaceful revolution against a brutal dictatorship? The only way you get rid of a brutal dictatorship is the ones you describe would be an armed rebellion.
Hey, Juan, let me ask you a question. If you were hungry and you had no food, how likely would it be that you would rise up and conduct a peaceful revolution, or how likely would it be that you would spend most of your time looking for food?
the people will be, you know, growing food on their farms and whatnot, but
No, Juan, just answer the question. Don't dance around it. If you were hungry and you were living in Havana where most people live, or you were living in one of the big cities, how likely would it be that you would have enough energy if you were so devastated by hunger that you would rise up and go into the streets if you had no food? How likely would you be motivated to have a revolution?
Well, hunger is an enormous motivator.
Hunger is an enormous motivator to keep in bed until you get more food. It's not a motivator to get out in the streets. Juan, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call, too.
Well, I'm sorry. I mean, the economy and the military dictatorship is surviving off of the tourism industry with the hotels in Havana. And if we do not boycott those hotels, nothing will ever change.
All right, Juan, thanks a lot. Well, Patrick, I mean, you said yourself that Cuba doesn't have a free press. You would like to see some change. How would you envision change happening in Cuba if you don't agree with Juan, our last caller? How would you envision change happening in Cuba?
You know, first of all, I think that there are some things that the Cuban people would like to change. I think there's some things they wouldn't like to change. I don't think that they want to get rid of their free education. I don't think they want to get rid of their free health care. I think they would like to make sure the shelves are stocked in the hospitals with drugs and medications and bandages. I think they would like to be able to buy espresso machines and be able to buy jeans and be able to travel and to have things and to do those things. And I think they would like to be able to prosper from the education that they have. You have engineers who aren't making any money, doctors who aren't making any money, and taxi cab drivers are. But I don't want to change Cuba. I want Cuba to change Cuba. And so my issue is that Cuba poses no threat to the United States. Why don't I let them alone and let them find their natural way of moving forward and becoming a more prosperous country?
We're talking about Cuba with our guest Patrick Mantega, editor and publisher of the newspaper La Gaceta, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And Juan, thank you very much for your phone call. We're going to go back to the phones in just a second, and we'll put this caller on. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from? Okay, that is the scratchy line there. Let's see if we can take this call. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is John St. Pete.
Hi, John. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to say?
It just seems to me like we've always punished Cuba because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which, you know, they put nuclear missiles there. I think that's something that's always, you know, stuck in the back of everybody's minds because, you know, we deal with communist China, and we don't seem to have a real big problem with their political system over there as far as, you know, dealing with them and their, you know, their version of capitalism. So it seems to me it's just like we're trading one dictator for another, Castro for Trump. Trump wants to tell him what to do. And that just seems to me like it's not, you know, it's up to the Cuban people to do that. So,
well, and we keep moving the bar. Remember, Fidel's dead. Raul has retired. What? So now we don't even have a Castro to kick around anymore, but we're still there. We're still saying, oh, we've got to do it. You know, I used to hear back 20 years ago when I want to change, well, if we just wait for Fidel to move on, then we can do this. And then, well, if the Castro brothers are gone, we can do it. Well, both are gone, and we still can't do it.
The best way to combat communism is capitalism. And, you know, the Chinese are a prime example. They're the most capitalistic communists I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So if you want change, just let them start making money over there and you'll get change.
And that's what we had about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. You started to see this erosion of the socialist system and the communist system, for one, that started to mirror this combination between capitalism and between socialism. And, you know, whatever degree those two are going to mix, I don't think they had gone down the experiment far enough to figure out when it was going to stop. But you could see that the Cuban government was trying to think about the future as maybe a Chinese kind of style government as far as it. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John. Thanks. Patrick, I want to zigzag a little bit just because immigration is such a big issue in this country right now. I just want to ask you, from 1960 to recently when we had the wet foot, dry foot policy in place, about how many people from Cuba came here without, you know, they just arrived and they were accepted into our economy?
You know, I don't have a number on that. I know it's got to be hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. And it's been a very consistent flow. The only thing that's actually restricted the flow was 90 miles of water and our reluctance to allow people to come over in a safe way. You know, during the Bush years, we had a 20,000 limit of how many could come over through a process. And that way they didn't have to float over or anything like that. But most of the time, we would never even get to that quota because we got in the way of that quota. And that would put more pressure on people to get on a raft and float over and die perhaps or not die. And part of this was actually a strategy of people in the U.S. to try and keep the Cuban government really looking horrible and to keep this pressure up. And so, you know, we played a pawn. The Cuban people have been a pawn for us on trying to keep pressure on the Cuban government, as we currently are doing. You know, you're not starving the Cuban government. You're starving everybody in Cuba.
And people are starving. And do we still have the Cuban Adjustment Act where people come in and they get all sorts of benefits when they arrive here from Cuba?
No. But they. But I do think they are getting some preferential treatment still in claiming asylum.
And when was the Cuban Adjustment Act ended?
Under Obama.
Okay. Tony writes this from St. Pete. He said, Floridians should realize that our two U.S. senators, Marco Rubio and Rick Scott, were very much behind this despotic action by the Trump regime. Trump has done more to drive our two major world power enemies together, Russia and China, yet we are free to travel and trade with both. Another example of irrational dictatorial hypocrisy from our would-be despot. Those are Tony's words. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Marsha Ree writes, will you speak on the oil relationship historically between Venezuela and Cuba? Do you know much about the U.S., Cuba, and Venezuela? Do you know much about the oil connection?
Well, when Chavez first took over power, and the Cuban government certainly was a supporter of that and encouraged him. You know, one of the reasons, one of the ways that Chavez kept power was through providing medical services to the poorest poor in Cuba and Venezuela, and he was able to do that because Cuba shipped over 2,000 doctors to walk through the poor neighborhoods and to deliver services that those people never have had. They got all of a sudden eyeglasses. Their teeth were fixed, and these were great things. And so that helped Chavez really create a power base for himself through this. In return, the Cubans got free or discounted oil. And so a trade of oil for doctors. In the middle of all this, of course, the U.S. Was a large buyer of Venezuelan oil and through Citgo, which is still around, and a Venezuelan oil company here. And so the U.S. would try to adjust and fight the Venezuelans on this. But the U.S. never decided to work with Hugo Chavez. They always decided to treat him as an enemy. And while we were tightening the noose, he was sending doctors in the poor neighborhoods. And so if you're a Venezuelan and you're sitting there and the U.S. is saying you need to fight for freedom, and a doctor just knocked on your door and delivered healthcare services you've never had before, you don't mind the current way things are going. And so this is what happened. And once again, America lost its ability to influence in Central and South America and the Caribbean because we're only using a stick here. We're not using candy. And so, you know, if Cuba can have a better relationship with Venezuela because it sends doctors in, maybe we could have figured out a way of trumping that as opposed to just, you know, whacking them around and saying you guys are bad.
This email says, wouldn't it be good to normalize relations with Cuba so we can expand the middle class there? It seems to have worked in China, writes Anonymous. All right. And Adam writes this, it's undemocratic to restrict your own citizens from traveling to another country, no matter whether the president is Republican or Democrat. All people who love freedom, which conservatives claim they do all the time, this should be against the policy, writes Adam. And then Imad writes, if Cuba was really a brutal dictatorship, the president would praise it. along with North Korea and Russia, writes him up. And then Tom is in Winter Haven. He says, travel bans are un-American. I've been to Cuba and found a lot more tourists from Canada and other countries than from the U.S. Even when travel was legal, I was told by our tour guide that Marco Rubio tried to kill the trip. I'm old enough to have known people who came here under Batista, and when Bolita was running out of Havana and resulted in corruption and murder in Central Florida.
You know, and we can argue all day about whether there's human rights restrictions and violations in Cuba. We can argue all day about what's going on there. But what I don't think we can argue about is why are we involved in this? Why are we using U.S. citizens and blocking their freedoms as a way of trying to influence a foreign government that poses no threat to us economically or militarily? There is nothing Cuba is doing to hurt the United States. They're not, you're not seeing terrorists coming out of Cuba here. You're not seeing any of this stuff. And so it's just such a strange thing for the U.S. to focus this much of its power on such a small target, such a helpless target as Cuba.
So, Patrick, before the Castro Revolution, the most, I think it's fair to say, Cuban Americans that lived here were pretty liberal. And if you go back to 1937, 38, 39 in Ybor City, they were gathering money to send ambulances to the Republicans in Spain. These were the liberals, the leftists in Spain. Mm-hmm. Then the Cuban migration happens, and the Cuban population turns from being mostly liberal to being, I think it's fair to say, mostly conservative here in the Tampa Bay area.
Okay. If you're a Cuban exile, you generally hate Kennedy and vote Republican. If you are a Cuban or family who immigrated before 1959, you generally love Kennedy and vote Democrat.
And that's a tradition for other countries, too. Other countries, as dictatorships collapse in Central America, the fans of that dictatorship tend to come up here. So.
Sure. I mean, you know, a lot of the people who traveled here were Batista's henchmen. They were people who were bad to the people of Cuba. You know, we have a Supreme Court justice here in the state of Florida who was the grandson of Batista. Gloria Estefan's father was ran the secret police there under Batista. So, you know, a lot of the people here that have influence on the U.S.-Cuba policy also had family who were bad players in the issue of the Batista government. And so, you know, a lot of the U.S. policy has been shaped by people who were part of the Batista government, who fled here early, who took out their money of Cuba, and because of that money had influence not only on the U.S. government, but also on Cuban exiles who came over later who weren't able to bring out their money.
And it seems like a lot of money from wealthy people, whether it be Venezuela or Colombia or Nicaragua, when that money flees those countries, it comes here to Florida.
Sure.
And a lot of it is in Miami and...
Yeah, well, and what you see with the Venezuelan community, they're really trying to take pages out of the Cuban exile community playbook, and they've done a great job of it. They are courting the Republican Party. The Republican Party has decided that its next group of minorities that can become solid Republicans is this Venezuelan community. So they're really catering to them. They're doing everything they can to give them what they want, and they're looking for loyalty in the votes. I don't think this is because Republicans really care about Venezuela.
Or human rights.
I don't think they care about human rights. I don't think they care about any of these things. I think what they see is that, you know, they've got another minority community here to cater to. You know, the Democrats have to deal with blacks and gays and Hispanics and Hondurans and Nicaraguans and Mexicans and the whole wide group. The Republican Party has Cuban exiles. Now they want to add Venezuelan exiles. And in the state of Florida, those are just enough votes to get you across 50%.
Patrick Mantega is here. He's the editor and publisher of the trilingual newspaper that's published in Ybor City called La Gaceta. Let's go to Gino in Tampa. Gino, you're on. What's your question?
Yes, my understanding is that really Trump doesn't care anything about Cuba.
he's just trying to overturn anything that Obama did. If Obama said, okay, he was going to block us communicating with Cuba, Trump probably would have came in and opened it up. It's totally opposite. It just appears to me that Trump is just doing the opposite as Obama, almost as trying to wipe out his legacy as though he could have, and he can't.
All right, Gino, thanks a lot. Would you agree, Patrick?
You know, I can't disagree or agree with Gino because there's no way I can figure out what motivates Donald Trump to do anything. So if anybody has that answer, I'd love to have a long letter written to me about it because I can't figure it out.
Let's go to Susan on Anna Maria Island. Susan, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi. I went to Cuba in December, and I'm really disappointed by this decision, but I kind of saw it coming. You know, because, yeah, like your caller before said, anything that President Obama did, you know, Trump wants to undo. But it's kind of personal for me because we hired a guy, and she was 23 years old, going to the university. We keep in touch. And now I'm wondering if we can even email each other. So,
did you think your money helped the brutal dictatorship, or do you think it helped your 23-year-old guide?
Oh, it definitely helped her. As a matter of fact, I it's not really funny, but I sent her a care package, and I asked her. I said, you know, what can I send you? Because if I asked my daughter, she'd say like a Michael Kors purse. And this girl said, well, a hairbrush. And I was just, you know, flipped out over that. So I went down and I bought just a bunch of things, and the box was 19.5 pounds. It cost me $115 to send it, which that's okay because I promised her I'd send it. Well, when she got it, she had to pay $142, what are they, CUCs?
Right.
To get it.
Yep.
So, but I would do it in a minute. And yeah,
you know,
she hasn't been there.
And part of that is the Cuban government is trying to tax some of the Cuban Americans who are sending stuff to Cuban families there. Because they realize that the reason why Cuba, this current policy exists, is because of the Cuban Americans here. We would not have this restrictive policy if the Cuban Americans here did not insist on it. And it's not a lot of them, but it's a few of them. So the Cuban government has decided, well, if you're going to tighten the screws on us, then we're going to tax you and your family, and that's what you're seeing. And when you see those kinds of costs happening for Cubans there, because they realize who's keeping this policy in place.
Right, exactly. And your other caller that said, you know, starve the people, absolutely not. I mean, these are beautiful people. And just my husband and I being there, I mean, we're only two people, but we used all our transportation. We used all kinds of transportation. I mean, horseback, you know, everybody was fabulous. We ate in their restaurant, drank in their bars. The people are amazing, and I know that opening up Cuba has helped them immensely, and there's no reason for it to be closed, you know, for them to close it off to us again.
You know, I agree with you, and most of the people who still say we should be not do this and that we shouldn't open it up are people who refuse to go there. If you go there, it's hard to come up with a solution that starving these people is a way to help them.
All right. Susan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. The Trump administration yesterday announced new restrictions on American travel to the island of Cuba, 90 miles off Florida's shore, including an end to cruise ships and group tours. We're talking about that with Patrick Mantega, the editor and publisher of La Gazzetta. David writes this, when I visited Cuba to make a documentary, there were many tourists from many countries, but few Americans. This new policy is destructive, writes David. And Wendy writes this, again, I'm fascinated by your guest and completely agree with his assessment. I was able to sail over there a couple of times in the 90s, and my experiences were wonderful and varied. I traveled privately in the country and saw very little military presence. Sorry, you're having phone issues. All right, Wendy, thanks a lot for that nice email. That's a good question. I mean, and I talk about this a lot when people come back from Cuba. It's often called a police state by people like President Trump. When you travel to Havana or when you travel around the countryside, do you see police everywhere?
You know, when I first went to Cuba back in 1999, I knew nothing about Cuba. I knew that Fidel Castro had been born directly from the devil, that he had horns, that he had a pitchfork that he stabbed the people of Cuba with, that they ate all the dogs and cats, so there I wouldn't find any. I knew that there would be police on every corner. They would have guns. They would be bayoneting poor babies who are reading Bibles. And when I got over there, I realized that somebody had done a number on me, because none of those things did I see. You know, I did not find a government where papers were being checked on the street corner. I saw people hitchhiking. What kind of restrictive government allows thousands of people to hitchhike, you know, going here and there? The streets were filled with people. I found dogs and cats. I actually took pictures of dogs and cats. So when I came back, I would do a few slideshows about them just to show that they actually exist. Now, maybe Castro's police were putting them on the blocks I was on to make sure that I wouldn't report that they ate all their dogs and cats. But I found them there. And it was just, I'd realized what a big lie I had been told. And I have to tell you that the first time I went down there, I get to the hotel and the phone rings. I don't know why the phone's ringing, because calling from the U.S. to Cuba is very difficult. Nobody knew which room I was in. And I had my wife with me, and I pick up the phone, and there's a gentleman on the phone. I can't remember his name, but let's just say his name's Mr. Smith. He said, "Mr. Mantega?" I go, "Yes." He goes, "This is Mr. Smith. I'm with the United States Special Interest Section, and we have a car parked across the street, and we'd like you to come and get in the car, because we would like to brief you about the lies the Cuban government is going to tell you during your 4 days here. And so we'd like to take you to the interest section to do this." So I thought really hard for a very short period of time, and I told them, I said, "You guys have had 40 years to lie to me. Give them 4 days, and I'll talk to you in the U.S.
Did you ever talk to them when you got back to the U.S.?
They didn't want to talk to me in the U.S. What they wanted to do was, they wanted to poison my trip. Had I gone to the U.S. intersection, nobody in the Cuban government would have talked to me, because it would have looked like I was American spy, I was doing something, not a journalist, not trying to do, you know, be somebody open and wanting to learn.
But did you feel like he wanted to be your handler or the shaper of your news report when you got back? Did you have a Cuban handler? Did any Cubans like follow you around wherever you went for those 4 days?
Was there people who worked for the Cuban government who were part of our party or who were tour guides who might have had a relationship? Absolutely. I'm sure.
No, they were there.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Let's go to David in Tampa. David, you're on with Patrick Mantega.
Hey, Patrick. This is David from Bud Lee. I went to Cuba in 2001, too, to make a film, documentary of the shooter. And we were there over a month and a half. And I know, you know, this is a while back, but Cuba was a beautiful place, beautiful people, no handlers, nobody messed with us, you know, and we had a great experience. I did know, I was the fellow that sent email. There was lots of tourists everywhere. We traveled most of the island, and there was very few Americans except in Havana.
Correct.
Not outside of Havana. So I just wanted to tell you that.
David? Did we lose you?
Oh, there you are. Yeah.
So we lost
your trouble.
Yeah, we lost that last thought of yours.
Well, the main thing I wanted to say, my cousin lives in Toronto. My first cousin, my parents are Canadian. She runs the marketing branch of Procter & Gamble, which is a rather large corporation. She will not, when they do advertising that involves tropical images in the background, she will no longer come to Florida. She says it's much harder to cross our border with her shooters or her staff and camera crew, because they're from different countries in many cases. And she says it's so much easier to just go to Cuba. So that's just a little footnote for you guys.
All right, David, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
It's interesting that they're boycotting tourism to Florida because of our brutal dictatorship.
So Suzanne writes this: can Americans still go to Cuba if they travel through another country to get there? If we go to a country that has direct flights to Cuba, let's say that we go to, I'm just guessing. You mentioned Nicaragua.
We've always been allowed to go illegally to Cuba, so long as nobody catches you and you don't come back and post pictures on your Facebook of you hanging out at the National Hotel. So, yeah, I mean, you can go to the Bahamas, and you can walk right over to the other side of the airport, get a flight to Cuba. When you show up in Cuba, you tell them do not stamp your passport, which they normally don't anyway. Then you fly back to Bahamas, and nobody knows you're there, especially now because there's very few Americans in Cuba because we've basically closed the embassy. And so there's nobody there checking on you at the moment. So, yeah, you can get there illegally.
Let's go to Bruce in Tarpon Springs. Bruce, we're talking about the restriction on travel to Cuba. Hi, Bruce. You're on M&F.
Yes. Yeah, I crewed on a sailboat in the last Concord public race from Key West to Cuba. And it was interesting because they made no bones about the fact that they didn't want us going there. We went under the loophole of bringing humanitarian supplies to the Cuban people. So we just put a case of ibuprofen at Walmart and went down there. Cuban people were very gracious. We went on a tour to Matanzas from Altadadero, where the race ended. And there's Cubans, there's Dutch and Canadians all over the place, but no Americans. Spent some time at Marina Hemingway in Havana. Everybody was really terrific. We got back to Key West, and they were searching all the boats and looking for any Cuban things that we brought back. We're allowed to bring back artwork, but they still took the CDs we bought there. But I saw them taking the film out of everybody's camera. So I took my cartridge and put it in a coffee cup and said, I'm drinking coffee on the customs dock. I'm the only one on the fleet to have pictures of Cuba. They said they were trying to see if they can get pictures of us spending greenbacks, which was, of course, not allowed. The race was fully funded by Marina Hemingway, all the fuel and all the accommodations, so we didn't have to spend greenbacks. But, of course, we did anyway. Subsequently, when we got back, the organizers of the race were indicted for arranging a tour to Cuba under false pretenses. The captain of our boat appeared before a grand jury, investigating that. And the grand jury looked over, looked like a whole bunch of old Miami Cubans. It was an election year, and right after the election, of course, they dropped all the charges. So, go figure. But it was a great trip. The Cuban people were terrific. I'd love to go back, but I don't want any problems with customs or...
Well, I'm certainly glad the customs people were searching you as opposed to searching people trying to bring nuclear missiles into our country or something like that. We had to stop you from bringing rum and cigars in.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Bruce, thanks a lot. Thank you, Bruce. Thanks for your story. Well, Patrick Mantega, thanks for spending the whole hour with us and talking about the new restrictions on travel to Cuba.
It went by fast. I thought you only wanted me for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I only wanted you for 10 minutes. So, the newspaper is La Gaceta, G-A-C-E-T-A, published every Friday in Ybor City in Tampa, but available widely around Florida. So, and Patrick, are you online? Is your paper online?
We are, but we only mention a couple lines of each article, and we say, if you like this, go buy a newspaper.
All right. So, what's the website?
The website is www.lagacetanewspaper.com.
All right, Patrick Mantega, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming by WMNF.
Thanks.
If you want to comment about today's show, call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. I'm Rob Lori. This has been Radioactivity. And coming up in the next hour, NOLA is taking a day off. So we're going to hear the Tom Hartman radio program in the next hour. First, the NPR News, though. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota. QRC. Oh,